Blog Talk Radio.
Another edition of the Don and Ron program coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'm your co-host, Ron Edwards. I've been with you for the last four Wednesdays. My associate and co-host, Mr. Allen, is on academic assignment, if you will. He has indicated he will be back with us next week, and the phone lines will be opened back as we have basically analyzed and carried a number of issues, but also reflected on the history, if you will, the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. and some of the actions taking place around the United States and, by extension, the world, if you will. And so, once again, we appreciate you allowing us to come in to your homes, to your private space, through your computer, and et cetera. You heard the song of introduction, if you will. I'm not sure that here in the Twin Cities, it's really a happy enclave, particularly for the NAACP Minneapolis branch. Well, really the entire NAACP movement here in the state of Minnesota, and certainly Black Lives Matter. But let me touch on a couple of other national situations that certainly have caught the attention. We first reported a couple of weeks ago that there was the possibility of real problems in a place called Burns, Oregon, if you will, which is in the southeastern part of the state of Oregon. Beautiful country out there, as we said a couple weeks ago. But there has been kind of a state of siege at a small government wildlife facility under the Bureau of Lands and et cetera. And it turned violent late last night, earlier this morning, if you will. According to the FBI's communique, one individual was shot and killed, another one was wounded. We monitored an interview with a young lady who is a radio talk show host in Portland, Oregon, which is the largest city in the state of Oregon. And she talks in terms that witnesses to the altercation indicate that it was an ambush and there was a cold-blooded execution of Lavoie, an individual who was well-known within the circles, if you will, of dissidents and those who preach that the government has gone too far. This is what has led to the situation in Burns, Oregon. Small town, out in the wilderness, as we said. A town that has gained notoriety because the residents, the homebred, if you will, indicate that those that have come into that part of Oregon, the largest Holly County, the largest county in the state of Oregon, and the, ninth largest county in the United States. People say they don't want trouble. They don't want the federal people in their business. But that has now escalated. We received a call earlier today from someone that we have known for quite some time on the West Coast. They asked what our assessment was of the possibility of retaliation and et cetera. They well remember our radio programs of almost 20 years ago when, after a series of confrontations between states' writers, if you will, posse comitatus and et cetera, including right up here in North Dakota, in Kansas, Missouri, other places, that there would be retaliation. And, of course, tragically, we in America saw that in a place called the Murrell Federal Office Building in downtown Oklahoma City, a man by the name of James McVeigh, a military veteran, if you will, trained by the American government, to be a demolitions expert and et cetera. We never did really hear a lot of explanations on his training and mindset and et cetera, because in many respects his whole trial and proceeding, he of course received the death penalty as he should have, based on the number of people that he killed in the bombing of the Murrell Federal Building, and particularly, how can any of us forget it? I was in Oklahoma City within hours. After the bombing, I can still see the scenes, if you will, of the front of that building blown off. There were still actually sheets and et cetera that had been put over some of the bodies that were hanging over the edges of the building and et cetera. People, I assume, well know and well remember. We spent a period of time in Oklahoma City. We reported, in fact, from Oklahoma City later that week, and we saw some interesting situations, and we talked about it quite a bit on our television and radio programs. That we are now in our 26th year of cable here in the city of Minneapolis, in the Twin Cities, 26 years, about the same amount of time in radio and et cetera. And we realized how uneasy that we felt about how the feds really didn't talk in terms of how McVeigh almost got away. If it had not been for the license plate that allegedly fell off his car, catching the attention of an Oklahoma state trooper going up 35 north, we believe at that time, and as we reported, he was heading towards Route 412 and then turning after going through Tulsa to Route 44 for a meeting and a rendezvous at a motel just outside of Joplin, Missouri. For those of you that, you know, are mystery buffs and et cetera, I know that you know where you can obtain the information about that. McVeigh still is a hero within the survivalist community. There were two associates, both of them blood brothers, who had a farm just north of Detroit. For those of you that tend not to remember that American tragedy, who actually were running a farm that really was a training ground, similar to some of the ones we've mentioned over this program over the last year, particularly after Charleston and the terrible carnage at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. We have talked about on this program, we find it interesting that there has not been a lot of in-depth investigation on where Dylan Root was actually going and how it was that there was basically 14 hours that can't be accounted for. We repeat what we said a couple months ago, that he actually stopped in a small town called Hope, South Carolina, and he was on his way to a survivalist enclave in the far western reaches of North Carolina, at a survivalist facility, and then north into Tennessee, where there are some real interesting ongoing activities as it pertains to paramilitary groups, white supremacists, and et cetera. But we basically know that the mainstream media is not prepared to take these kinds of issues on, if you will. And so in the situation in Oregon, just north of Burns, Oregon, along Route 20 and State 395, after the governor criticized the federal government and the FBI for being soft on terrorists, in our column of 3 weeks ago in the oldest African-American newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, we said that we wondered why there was such resistance by the mainstream media, white media, to identify Mr. Bundy and his crew, Mr. Bundy, the gentleman out of Virginia, who also is active in places like Utah and Montana, and ooh, particularly my good friends up there around Spirit Lake and Spirit River, just to the west of Sandpoint, Idaho, if you will. Them old homeboys have been doing their thing. Hey, they are planning for the Chronicles, if you know what we mean. But anyways, we looked at that, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in Oregon. Mr. Bundy, the father of the two young men who led the insurgency into, well, just south of Burns, Oregon, has maintained that the issue is now in the courts and has told his people to stand down. Of course, that's a good way to do it. You don't want to be indicted for incitement, if you will, and that's always a possibility of what is happening. Well, on to the local scene here. A lot of tension in my city. It's been going on, obviously, for quite some time. Factions are at each other, if you will. Black Lives Matter, the Minneapolis branch, NAACP, the state conference, and others maintaining that they represent the new leadership and the face and the new face of leadership here within the Twin Cities. There are many who express doubt about that and apprehension and et cetera and et cetera. But it was an event this morning, which now is being carried on social media for all of those of you that are, you know, naysayers or indicate that, somebody's just making something up. That's why we love doing narratives, if you will, giving everything from highway routes, if you will, to camps, survivalist camps, training camps, facilities where people are training for the coming revolution. Now, we're not talking about no black folk now. we're talking about Billy Bob in the tradition of 13 Hours and the addition of Sniper and et cetera. So let's be for real that there's kind of a different set of rules. As someone said in the Portland Oregonian, the largest newspaper in the state of Oregon, and one of the more respected newspapers in the United States, that if that had been a group of black people that would have come in from down from Portland and up from San Francisco and Los Angeles with some blue bandanas on and talking about, you know, black power and et cetera, they would have been routed out of there hours and days ago. And a whole lot of black folk would have been charged with conspiracy aiding and abetting and et cetera. But, you know, the authorities said they wanted to let them work it out. And so that takes us into the revelation this morning that it's kind of sad, if you will. On this program about a month ago, we had the sister of Mr. Jamar Clark, the young 24-year-old African-American, shot down and killed by police on the 15th day of November 2015 along a street here in Minneapolis called Plymouth Avenue, if you will, right across from the International Order of the Elks, if you will, the Elks Rest, and et cetera. It created situations that led to serious confrontations, if you will. It led to an occupation of the grounds in and around the 4th Precinct in North Minneapolis. People attempt to, particularly when they get on national television or national radio and are giving an analysis of what happened, make it appear that the protesters occupied, actually went in, took control of the police facility and et cetera. Now, that did not happen. They did surround it, and they maintained a camp, if you will, in and around. There was violence, if you will. The first violence was initiated by anarchists who were in support of Black Lives Matter and the NAACP. In fact, we refer to these anarchists and as the military wing of the NAACP, who was very happy to secure the quote-unquote perception of military tacticians and et cetera who were going to protect them. Of course, that evaporated when at least four or more white supremacist gunmen who had infiltrated over a four-day period the Black Lives Matter NAACP encampment opened fire on a group of five African-Americans, shooting all five. Luckily for everyone, there was no fatalities. A couple of the terrorists are still in jail. The county attorney here, a Michael Freeman, is not real enthusiastic about charging them, if you will, with a hate crime. That in itself is interesting because clearly it was a hate crime, because one of the things that happened about 4 days before the carnage was rendered and rained down upon African-American, five African-Americans there on a street called Morgan Avenue North in Minneapolis, 1300 block, is that the authorities, the Minneapolis Police Department, had notified the leadership of the NAACP and Black Lives Matter that there had been infiltration, that the authorities, specifically with the assistance of the federal authorities, who are, of course, the masters at electronic surveillance, that they had discovered a plot to commit mayhem and possible death on the protesters. The leadership of Black Lives Matter and the NAACP chose not to alert the masses of protesters and et cetera. And so on that particular night, five African-American men were caught off guard as a couple of gunmen opened fire, wounding all five of them. That became crucial because at the particular point in time, and now we get to the events of this morning here in our beloved Shangri-La, our enclave, is that a lot of resources were coming into the encampment, if you will. In fact, in some cases, people primarily, white, if you will, wanting to support whatever it was that they felt was happening in the name, and keep this in mind now, this was in the name of Jamar Clark, a 24-year-old African-American shot and killed by police in circumstances that are still under investigation. And by the way, we will really be dealing with that in the second half hour of tonight's program, so we will be with you until 9:30. But in the course of talking in terms of the commitment, if you will, of the Black Lives Matter group, a lot of money was dropped off, if you will. In fact, there was observation, some of it, by the way, by authorities who were filming and et cetera. And, of course, they had their operatives, undercover officers and agents in and moving around. But there were a lot of envelopes that were handed to some of you folks who are part of Black Lives Matter and the Minneapolis branch NAACP, in which there was money, if you will, for the Clark family, money to feed and help with the encampment by the protesters and et cetera, a lot of money. A couple of weeks later, actually on this program, we, with the permission of the African-American, a Mr. Hugger, who interviewed one of the sisters of Mr. Clark. She had returned to Illinois, in which she charged that better than $100,000 in donations, checks, and gifts had been raised, if you will. There were at least five separate bank accounts, if you will. The Clark family, particularly that segment of his family out of Illinois, had gone to the banks. They were starting to ask leadership of the Black Lives Matter and NAACP for an accounting, if you will. We were reviewing this afternoon with associates around the country some of the blog postings, if you will, by bloggers who have been watching, as they watch all situations, be it Cleveland or Ferguson, if you will, or Milwaukee, you know, New York City, and et cetera, watch, and they record what it is that people say. And just as on the morning and throughout the day of the 15th of November, we in the general public were being told that there was all kinds of videos and documentation that showed the actual moment of death of Mr. Clark. And in fact, that particular week, we talked about that on this program, if you will, opened our phone lines. We were awaiting word that someone had probably sold their video to CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, particularly Fox, CNN, and MSNBC, and, you know, for 10, 15, 20,000. But that didn't happen. And then as time went on, but as the occupation intensified and there was gunfire and fire bombings, and then different kinds of wood was being burnt on the streets of North Minneapolis along Plymouth Avenue, senior citizens began to complain to their city councilman, Blongyang. He ultimately, by the way, in very early January, held a public hearing to assess the concerns of the residents, if you will. And It was somewhat surprising to some folks that the residents of North Minneapolis in and about the immediate vicinity of the 4th Precinct were not all pumped up and fired up about all these protesters and what they were talking. Of course, there were then other kinds of actions that took place. Some of it then culminated on the 23rd day of December 2015 when a group of protesters under the banner of the NAACP and Black Lives Matter stormed MOA. Of course, they were met by a large counterforce of security, police, and et cetera, but that wasn't their real plan, according to them. They then moved away from MOA, as we all know, and laid siege and stormed the Humphrey Terminal at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Of course, as we said on these programs a couple of weeks ago, unbeknownst to them, the operatives and informants that are inside of their organization had already alerted their handlers to what was the plan. And as the protesters came in on the lower level, thinking that there was a unguarded and uncontested pathway of a flight of stairs, charged up those stairs, it was kind of like the movie Glory in that very graphic scene when Morgan Freeman and others storming the barricades, if you will, of the old fort there in South Carolina came storming around the corner, and the Confederates were waiting for them with a couple of those artillery pieces and, of course, fired at point-blank range with probably all kinds of metal and et cetera. And, of course, Morgan Freeman and other stars of the gathering and Denzel Washington and et cetera were all killed and became martyrs. So when the group was met at the airport, they ran for quite a surprise. Now, we were troubled by the fact that the leaders of the organizations, Black Lives Matter, NAACP, and other groups there now, and we said, four factions of Black Lives Matter in the Twin Cities. But we were concerned that the most principal person was not there with her troops, that in the tradition of Joan of Arc, if you will, the great patriot and patron saint of, quote-unquote, the first French Revolution, if you will, did not storm the barricades with her supporters and et cetera. But then later we found out that she was in Southern California. In fact, I do believe she was in San Diego, enjoying the beach and leisure time and refreshing herself and et cetera. The rest of her associates, some went to Texas. So we have all of this on file. Records are here, if you will. And so we began to be concerned. And so, in early January, we began to ask the question of colleagues and others, what kind of progress was being made in the investigation of the circumstances surrounding the death of Jamar Clark. Well, people were fairly dismissive, if you will. They, didn't have time for that, and other things were now happening, and there was an incident at MOA, and a couple of new ministers with their niece were talking in terms of how their niece had been violated, 14-year-old young African-American girl who, unfortunately, got caught up in curfew / trespassing, but there was a lot of conversation again. But this commentator asked the question again, what's happening with the investigation? Are any reports or any at least weekly reports going out from the groups that have gained so much from their, quote-unquote, in their eyes, passionate defense and call to arms and et cetera in the case of the death of Jamar Clark? Well, people said, really don't have time to talk about that, busy doing some things and et cetera. Well, as we've said on a couple occasions, including our television program here in the Twin Cities, that a week after the tragic death of less than a week, really, after the death of Mr. Clark, we were approached by a couple of witnesses. One we felt was extremely reliable, and in fact, we later determined and confirmed that this individual was probably within 15 feet or just a tad more at the particular moment that the shot was fired in which Mr. Clark died. And we were asked to advise this witness. There was another witness that had reached out to us. We still, so that they know and understand, we still have their text message to us at our number, if you will, in which the person indicated that they had made a decision that they would not step forward at this time. They had been advised by Ecumenical or whoever, I mean, you know, and so we never press people. If you don't feel it in your heart to do the right thing, to bring forward an effort to provide justice, then you can't make people do that. And then what begins to happen, they wither under the pressure of what has to happen. And this is a real pressure case here. You know, even though the Star Tribune, the major television stations, and et cetera, are declining and backing away from giving any in-depth analysis and et cetera. And by the way, while that is happening, a holy war is apparently breaking out between the Police Federation and the leadership of the MPD, certainly in the firing of two veteran police officers, including a member of the Federation's Board of Directors, which is supposed to be an absolute no-no by Chief Janae Harto, if you will. By the way, her confirmation hearing to a second term will take place on the afternoon of the 3rd of February. That is a week from, week from today, if I'm not mistaken, before the Public Safety Committee under the chairmanship of Councilman Democrat 5th Ward Long Yang. And so people will have an opportunity to come in and state why they feel that the chief does not deserve another term. We are on record and continue to be on record. We think that she's done as good a job, particularly during the occupation, that one could do under all of the circumstances. But back to the firing of two white officers by the chief over the last couple of days that have been formally announced, clearly the Federation is looking for blood in the water. So that will be interesting. It will be good to keep your eye on that. Now, we've kind of tantalized you a little bit. We're coming up on the bewitching hour of nine, as you said. And that is the revelation this morning by the Reverend Jerry McAfee, the Reverend Billy Russell, and Bishop Howe, and at least the two activists who put their commitment where their mouth was, former police officer Alicia Clemens and her brother Alfred Flowers. Watching with great distress, if you will, and sadness, the disrespect and the lack of follow-up in the case of arrangements and the final arrangements for Jamar Clark, went into their own pockets and raised and paid out $1,300 this morning for a headstone. Now, as we have said on these programs, and it has been said on these programs by members of the family a month and a half ago, is that they maintain that over $100,000 was raised out of at least five bank accounts, if you will. People get real funny, get real uneasy in our beloved city when folks asked in terms of what is happening, but continuously ask this commentator and my co-host, Mr. Allen, and others, what not only was happening with the Jamar Clark investigation, but did he ever get a headstone? And I just would say to people, no, he never got a headstone. It never happened. It looks like that, you know, if folks could take $27,000 of the money being given to the family and put it in their pocket and buy them a new BMW SUV and and et cetera. And there were others of y'all out there. You know who you are. You're listening in tonight. So if not, you will go and listen to this program on demand. You know who you are. You know what it was that you did. As I said earlier, at the top of this program, we looked in and are looking and have in our quote-unquote covert files our statements being made back around the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th of November, when some of you were meeting with the family and you were playing the role of double agent, if you will, some saying that they were the spokesperson, if you will, for the for the family and et cetera. That kind of dissipated during a very emotional meeting at the Urban League under the leadership of Steve Belton, the now permanent president of the Urban League, when I well remember the scene when a member who said they were the spokesperson for the family had to demand that Mr. Belton allow them to address the group after Mr. Clark's blood relatives, if you will, had thanked the community and talked in terms that they were seeking justice. They were not here to call for violence and et cetera, though some of you in the NAACP and Black Lives Matter know that you attempted to entice them, if you will, to co-opt them into taking action of violence and et cetera. But cooler heads prevailed. And so this morning, as we said this earlier, Reverend McAfee, Bishop Howell, the Reverend Billy Russell, the president of the Black Baptist State Convention, a Mrs. Clemens, and Mr. Alfred Flowers reached into their pockets and provided the money to buy and secure a headstone for 24-year-old Jamar Clark, a man whose spirit had been promised that he would at least be graced with that final piece of, if you will, history. Some may call it an ornament or et cetera, but that is the headstone that will forever certainly identify your final resting place and et cetera. When I received the information this morning, I said, well, you know, we as journalists are obligated. My colleague here on this program, Mr. Donald Allen, began to post immediately, if you will. Others began to post all during the day. We've been waiting for, quote-unquote, Black Lives Matter and the NAACP, who have called these ministers nothing more than poverty pimps and crooks and et cetera, to at least indicate why it was necessary for Reverend McAfee, for Bishop Howe, for Reverend Billy Russell, and for two civilians or community people, Ms. Clemens and Mr. Flowers, to go into their pocket. And of course, Reverend or Pastor Billy Russell, of course, is actually representing the State Baptist Convention, but the fact of the matter is he took leadership within his organization to say, let's do the right thing in the spirit, if you will, of properness. And when I say properness, I'm talking in terms of that you allow a person to go to meet his maker, their maker, if you will, with dignity and integrity. You just don't strip people of that. And to have had all that money that these folks raised and put in their pockets and et cetera, and have now transferred to other banking accounts and et cetera, it was a sad commentary to see that it took some folks that had been called everything under the Son of God to make the decision in the spirit, in the spirit of fellowship. And so our appreciation goes out to the Reverend Billy Russell, to Bishop Howe, to the Reverend Jerry McAfee, to Ms. Clemens, and to Alfred Flowers, for at least having the intestinal fortitude and the spiritual commitment to do the right thing for the memory of a young man who had been promised so many things in death, as it appears that he also was in life. But in the promises made to him in death, there were many power brokers, if you will, significant movers and shakers who took full advantage of that money that was doled out to y'all, oftentimes unbeknownst to you, under the watchful eye of the authorities, as envelopes were handed to you, people stuffed them in their pockets, et cetera. Made a lot of money. And don't be mad at this commentator. Don't be mad at my associate, Mr. Allen. You know, we merely repeated what we heard from the blood relatives of the deceased. See, nobody is prepared to go out there and challenge them black women who came here to bury their loved one, who were told that there would be significant contributions and et cetera to help the family and et cetera and et cetera and et cetera. and it never happened. I remember how sad I felt that night on this program when we listened to the interview by Mr. Hugger, of one of the sisters of Mr. Clark, as she was at her home in Illinois, when she said, "We received nothing." And then she very quietly said, "My brother doesn't even have a headstone." And I, you know, text to my associate, Mr. Allen, "Are we hearing that right? I mean, could this?" So, in fact, one of the things we intend to do, again, for you naysayers out there, and et cetera, is that we intend to replay that interview with young Mr. Hugger and the sister that was played a month ago, in which everyone would have had an opportunity to have raised the question, to question each and every one of us with regards to what are you guys saying? Because some people had said, and particularly some of our white friends and citizens had said, they couldn't believe that he didn't have a headstone. I mean, some people were saying, "I gave him $800, I gave him $1,500, I gave him $3,000. Oh, yeah, these folks been talking. Now, some of these folks are the kind of people that believe in doing the right thing in their transactions with the IRS. You know, and of course you have a law professor that is leading you and et cetera. I think she probably can tell you, God help you, if too many people start coming in talking about donations to Black Lives Matter and to the NAACP. NAACP, by the way, could very much be in trouble because they don't seem to have any bonding or insurance, if you will. And so if they are sued as an organization, the national NAACP in Baltimore, Maryland, who holds the so-called universal policy of bonding and insurance and et cetera, would get hit with that. That, by the way, would be the quickest thing to have your organization closed down. But anyways, again, appreciation and prayers to those that stepped forward this morning and made it possible for a young man to receive that which had been promised to the wide world in his name and under the grace and guidance of God. Somebody stepped up to the plate. You need to text them. I know y'all are all out there texting and et cetera. You need to text them and say thank you, if you will. Well, that brings us now to our breaking report last week. Also, we encourage you to view our column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the oldest black newspaper in the state of Minnesota, at 12:01 a.m. this morning. We published a story which talked in terms of what has happened to the investigation involving the death of Jamar Clark, if you will. We continue to stand by our statements and call to arms, if you will, and we will share this with you tonight. This is for all, again, the naysayers and et cetera, because we understand as a black man in America how dangerous this kind of situation is and that all kinds of things can happen to you and et cetera. But you see, we are an old warrior, been out here a long time, man. We came over the hedgerows in 1958-59 as a young African-American, full of fire and vinegar and all about the revolution, and really believe what Frantz Fanon was saying when he talked about the War of Algiers. That's for those of you that take your time and read all of history, if you will. As we have reported, we are greatly concerned. We are greatly saddened by the fact that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has undermined the integrity and, by extension, the importance of the probably most important witness who saw everything that happened, and in the course of giving a statement to the authorities about 7 days after Mr. Clark lost his life, that an attempt has clearly been made over the last couple of weeks to destroy the credibility of this African-American witness. Yes, we will let you know it's an African-American. You know, we know they'd like to find some white heroes. Maybe y'all can find some. We know that some of the media Star Tribune television stations, or et cetera, saying we can't go with anything about this unless we can find a white hero kind of thing. Well, it's tough to do that when you don't have any white heroes out there who know the insides of what has happened and how this whole thing began to shape itself and how a decision was made by an investigator to undermine an investigation and attempt to give aid and protection to possibly a situation that under color of law that there was both culpability and negligence, if you will. But we have heard people since our broadcast of last week indicate that, you know, unless the white boys and white girls indicate that it happened and give legitimacy to it, it is irrelevant. That's one of the reasons why we're at the bottom of the totem pole. It is one of the reasons why we are just absolutely wiped out as an African-American community. I get so sick and tired of seeing the editorial commentaries and et cetera in the major news, white newspapers and et cetera, talking in terms that it's time to work on diversity and get it together and et cetera. I was in a meeting today, a closed meeting, with some interesting heavy hitters, if you will, and a couple of black women really brought up the right kind of stuff, and they started talking in terms of what was happening and the absence of being able to recruit and swear and post and position African Americans and others of color as law enforcement officers in our beloved city. And they were so right, these African American women in this particular meeting. And then later, I have to tell you that they were joined by a black lieutenant, they were joined by a black deputy chief of police. Neither of these black men bit their tongues, if you will. It was then joined by two Somali brothers, one a respected and decorated sergeant of the MPD, the other a man who is very much involved with a nonprofit and is a member of, quote-unquote, a Department of Justice Oversight Committee. And it was interesting to see and hear the discussion and to hear the anger and the frustration that really resides in our community with regards to folks know and understand better than we want to give them credit for of what is happening. One of the greatest obstructions to diversity and integration of quote-unquote whatever it is in Minneapolis city government is human resources. The people who run the tests, you know, mastermind the recruitments, decide who comes and who goes. It is human resources and the three-member commission that actually governs human resources called the Civil Service Commission. In fact, it was interesting and ironic tonight that basically nobody in the room knew who the three commissioners were, if you will. But I've watched this for years as a former, federal monitor for the federal court, for the Federal District of Minnesota for 11 years over the fire department as an outgrowth of a case called Carter v. Gallagher, if you will. I have become well-schooled, extremely sharp in knowing and understanding how the game is played, and I've just been amazed at how the silence that has emerged within Minneapolis city government about what is probably one of the worst mechanisms for diversity, and that is human resources and the Civil Service Commission, and how the rules are twisted and accepted. In fact, let me share something with you, if you will, for those of you that want to go down and maybe test the waters and et cetera. A former psychiatrist by the name of Dr. John Taborn, who also was a commander in the United States Navy, Dr. Taborn died of natural causes about 7 or 8 months ago. In the mid-1980s, he was brought in to evaluate and make recommendations with regards to psychological testing because, see, that's how they're knocking y'all out here in Minneapolis. All these white psychiatrists maintain that all Negroes, and there are so many of them that have been wiped out, are really a threat to the society and a threat to themselves and are really not qualified, if you will, to be law enforcement officers and et cetera. That's why the number of law enforcement black law enforcement officers in Minneapolis stays at around the mark of 65 to 70 and no more. But let me just say this to my listening audience, if you will, particularly as a historian and et cetera, I can remember as a young man coming up in the late 1950s where, hell, we had only three Negroes on the police department, and we were lucky to have them. We had no firefighters back in those days. It took us, oh, yes, it took us going into federal court in Carter v. Gallagher. In fact, for 100 years in this city, and I know history isn't important to many of those of you that are out there. It should be, because it could determine your future and your destiny. But I can well remember the fact that for 100 years, we had no more at any point in time, from basically 1877, 78 for a hot moment, and then officially around 1884, 85, and we never had any more than three Negroes as police officers sworn. Oh, by the way, in this town up until probably the early 1930s, a Negro patrol officer, all three of them, could not arrest a white citizen. It was like down home. It was like in the South. You could, quote-unquote, go ask the white officer to assist you in the arrest. In fact, the white officer had to make the arrest. If not, all charges would be dismissed and Negro officer would lose their job. In the case of the fire department, when the last Negro firefighter, who had been there for over 20 years, was retired in around 1924-25, the city made the decision they didn't need any more Negroes as firefighters. And from 1924 until the ruling in Carter v. Gallagher in 1968, appealed to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, upheld and affirmed by that court, the honorable and respected Judge Earl Larson, making that significant and historical decision, if you will, to allow for the first time in 40-some years, if about 47 really, that the Minneapolis Fire Department would become integrated. Now, there was some missteps. In 1979, we had to go back into federal court. Oh, yes, I know some people don't like to hear the historical piece, but I always remind people, all you got to do is go down to the federal courthouse and go up there and ask the white clerks for the information, and it's all there in black and white. But in 1979, it was necessary for us to go back before, at that time, a new judge, Judge Larson, had taken senior status, and to ask that the court take an action and to sanction the city of Minneapolis and its fire department and the mayor and everybody else, city council, and et cetera. And lo and behold, that's what they did. And the federal court under federal judge Robert Renner, former U.S. attorney for the Federal District of Minnesota, the man who came the closest to directing a federal grand jury to indict a white police officer for the shooting death of Eric Benford, 1972 in Eagan, Minnesota. Yes, we talked about that. See, there's history here. But with $3 million disappearing and no Black History Museum, y'all will never know anything about it. So, you know, just do what you do best. Play like you don't know nothing. But the court set up a 10-member oversight committee with full authority to report immediately to the court any indiscretions, if you will, violations of the Carter v. Gallagher, and et cetera. And in fact, in the very early 1990s, there were two situations which we passionately, if you will, and with an absence of malice and forethought, reported to the court that the city of Minneapolis had violated the court order of Carter v. Gallagher. And do you know that judge fined the city of Minneapolis $500,000 each time, and within a year's period, he had fined them $1 million. See, they don't do that no more in the situation dealing with the issue of race, if you will. You don't let these people get into your business, and your black lawyers don't spend enough time and are not committed to do like them old black lawyers used to do, who would get out there. Thurgood Marshall comes to mind for any of y'all. Walter White and others who want to raise the question, who can do it, who can speak out, quote-unquote, if you will. And so that is a tad of history, because now I bring you to the final piece of tonight's program. There are some that assume, and they assume wrongly, that some of us, and particularly this commentator, and I know they can say that this Negro is bodacious, outrageous, if you will, got to be crazy and insane, because that's what they used to call us in the old South. When a black man would stand up, they would always say, "Oh, that's old Pete, that's old Willie. He's just crazy, old crazy Negro," if you will. But we have put together what we feel is a Pacific Bill of Particulars, as we said on the program last Wednesday, and as we said in our column in this morning's edition, or this week's edition of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder. We have asked and alerted the Department of Justice to take a formal action, and we are requesting the appointment of a special federal prosecutor from outside the state of Minnesota, and placing this investigation into the circumstances surrounding the death of Jamar Clark to be placed in the hands of that special prosecutor. This comes on the heels of an incident, by the way, that they're also trying to keep quiet. We are realizing a couple of television stations, and you folks knew about it, tried to suppress it. A Department of Justice attorney came here for that portion of the investigation that some of y'all asked for, that are tuned in and seething and et cetera. When you ask for a second investigation involving not the FBI, though the FBI has really at this point done no wrong, that a examination of the conduct of the police department and et cetera, and as well as allegations about things that happened both during the occupation, prior to the occupation, and et cetera, and et cetera. And a very talented and well-respected African-American assistant U.S. attorney was attempting to follow the case and had positioned himself at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehensions headquarters in St. Paul. Don't you know, my friends, tonight here in our beloved Shangri-La, the citadel of liberalism, if you will, the objectivity, and et cetera, do you know that white-dominated Bureau of Criminal Apprehension told that black man to get his ass out of their building? Oh, come on now, for those of y'all play like you don't know. It's the talk of the Law Enforcement and Judiciary Committee, just as it is the conversation piece that is now going forward with folks trying to figure out who was it in the judiciary that was sought out to help undermine this case. See, this is going to be a real ugly one at some point in time, because the Clark family, God bless them, will have a couple of options, because I am of the opinion that the investigation of the death of Mr. Clark has already been whitewashed. The statement given by the witness, a material statement under color of law, very detailed with great specificity, detailed, and et cetera, has disappeared, if you will. In fact, as we begin to close over the last 5 minutes, the witness, the man that was standing there and watched Mr. Clark die and lose his life, gave his statement and et cetera under color of law, trying to do the right thing for his community and et cetera, has not even been recontacted since the last week of November. I repeat that again. He has not even been contacted. And so the question has been posed, well, where is his statement, which should have been provided to him so that he could correct that statement? They wouldn't give it to him. You couldn't give it to him. You don't want it out there on the street. You bring him in to the offices of either the FBI, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, because the Minneapolis Police Department has certainly done the right thing in these circumstances. They are staying as far, far away as they possibly can. And you bring the witness in, and you let them read their statement. You let them initial the statement, any corrections, anything inconsistent with what the witness believed that they said, and et cetera. Of course, this is reinforced. Oh, that's right, by the way. The witness's testimony was, of course, captured on audio, if you will, and, in fact, also was captured on video. And I'm quite sure that the two investigators knew that until this witness, very courageous African-American, made the specific and detailed description of how and the circumstances in which Mr. Clark died under, if you will. People have asked me just in the last number of hours what is happening and et cetera. I said, really don't have a clue. If you want to get anything from me, you know, encourage the U.S. attorney to bring me before a federal grand jury, and I'll be happy to tell what you did, how you did it, who you involved, because I don't think, in closing, my friends, as we move into the last 4 minutes of tonight's program, I don't think that the persons inside of the judiciary, I just don't think that they're going to go along with this scam, if you will, with this action that has been taken to circumvent this case and to deny justice to the family and et cetera. Now, as we were saying just a couple of minutes ago, the family definitely still has the right of a civil action, but by and large, when you lose a criminal action, basically what the system does is makes a small offer to you, and that settles up everything, and everybody goes on about their business. But in this case, there has been an injustice, heaped upon it injustice, as it pertains to the death of a 24-year-old African-American. At a time when these kinds of issues bring great concern across the width and breadth and the heart of Black America and of people who are of similar minds, seeking fairness and justice, if you will. We said at the top of this program that just because the television networks here are stations, and just because the Star Tribune, the St. Paul Dispatch, and others don't indicate that it is worthy of the same kind of scrutiny as was had in Ferguson, in Milwaukee, in Cleveland, in New York, and other places, that it's not important. But someone told me today, they said, Brother Edwards, you have to understand that these people have been beaten to their knees. Our community has been beaten to its knees. They just don't want to rock the boat. Many of the leaders don't want to rock the boat. And in conclusion, those that told people on the morning and the afternoon and evening of the 15th day of November in the year of our Lord 2015 that they had at least 25 people who had taken videos of the actual death of Mr. Clark. And people are still waiting for those individuals to show up. But if I had not been respected and honored enough to be asked by a witness who trusted me to do the right thing, to accompany them, and to hear them give their side of the story with great, as I repeat again, great detail and specificity, what would have happened if that brother had had no one in that room? They would have said he was just a crazy Negro, didn't know what he was talking about. And see, for those in the judiciary, you know specifically talking about one of the statements made by the special agent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which was significant to these ears, long experience involved in many, many unfortunate cases of quote-unquote black deaths at the hands of the authorities, that a statement and a series of statements was made in discussing the case, which is a violation of the rules, that was putting in place the final nail in the quote-unquote box of integrity that is important to any witness in a highly volatile and dangerous situation in more regards than none. And the investigator knew what he was doing. That's why, to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehensions, I have said that I will give my testimony under oath before a federal grand jury. Let me just say this in closing in the last 30 minutes. I don't think nobody's going to take me up on my offer. But when I finally tell you what really went down, how bad it was, and what the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension did, I don't know if St. Paul police will want to, quote-unquote, interface with them in the future. On behalf of our very production staff, if you will, and our co-host will be back with us next week, Mr. Don Allen, let us, as a black community, stay strong. But more importantly, you better stay vigilant. I'm Ron Edwards. This is the Ron and Don Show.